From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Beyonce and Jay-Z dropped a surprise album over the weekend. We take a closer look. And The Humans, which won a Tony for Best Play, comes to L.A. Playwright Stephen Karam borrowed from his life for the family drama, but says it's not all true.
I just think you can go deeper and be more honest about the things that are really weighing on your mind, the questions that really keep you up at night, if you do hide behind a shield of fiction.
And we'll meet the paleontologist who's been an advisor on every Jurassic Park movie, including the new sequel. All that coming right up.
KPCC supporters include Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
And National Geographic's Jane, a documentary by Brett Morgan profiling conservationist Jane Goodall using more than 100 hours of lost archival footage. Emmy eligible in all categories. NatGeoTV.com/FYC.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Over the weekend, Beyonce and Jay-Z surprised fans with new music, an unexpected move that's become a signature for the hip-hop power duo. Recording as the Carters, Everything Is Love is a collaborative effort that picks up the story of their tumultuous marriage where Beyonce's Lemonade and Jay-Z's 444 left off. As with their earlier music, they apply the struggles of their marriage to larger issues facing African Americans, and the music video for the album's single features dancers inside the Louvre, a direct challenge to the white canon of Western art history. I spoke with Pitchfork writer Michelle Kim about Beyonce and Jay-Z's latest release, and we started with the significance of the new music video.
Art museums in general are spaces where there are white artists, a lot of white subjects, a lot of art that has been taken through colonial history, and I think them standing from the art, getting really close to it, almost challenging that history, is just them saying, we deserve to be in this pantheon of really, really highbrow art and that canon that is associated with things that are the opposite of us.
I want to play part of a song called Summer. It's the very first song on the album.
Let's make love in the summertime. Let's make love in the summertime. Be in each other's arms.
So there is a lyric in this song, love is universal, love is going to express itself as a form of forgiveness and compassion for each other. It almost feels like in some ways, if you look at Lemonade and 444, that we are almost watching a marriage in real time being told and worked out musically.
It's very particular the way that they're packaging the story of their marriage and how it's going through this alleged infidelity. Jay-Z allegedly cheated on Beyonce, and now they're putting out this album to tell everyone, hey, we're okay now. I feel like it's more like Beyonce is taking the wheel here and saying, I forgave this man.
If you were a therapist listening first to Lemonade and then to 444 and then listening to this album, how would you say they have evolved as a couple? What are they talking about now collectively that they might have been talking about a little bit differently as individual artists?
What really makes me impressed is Jay-Z's character growth throughout all of this. Listening to 444, admitting to these toxic masculinity, these tendencies that he has to be like a womanizer, a misogynistic, and him just coming to the plate and saying all that. Then with Everything Is Love, they're really wrapping that together, and he seems more like he understands why he cheated. In 713, there's a section where Jay raps about how black men are taught how to love through the black woman in their lives. It's not just about their relationship. It's about what they're trying to say about black love in general.
I want to ask you a little bit more about the performances in this song. Let's listen to a little bit of Beyonce rapping on the song, A
Sipping my favorite alcohol. I'm so lit, I need Tylenol. All of my people are free, I'm on. I feel no one want to see the stars. Sending the missiles out. Drinking my inhibitions out. 250 for the rich and me.
So what do you hear musically, performance-wise, about what Beyonce and Jay are doing on this record that may be different from what she was doing on Lemonade or he was doing on 444?
The song features two members of the Migos, the Atlanta rap group. It features Quavo and Offset, and it's produced by Pharrell. And I think it's really exciting because Beyonce has always been a rapper, but in her own melodic way. And now I think she's really leaning into this new rap persona where she's just spitting bars, really in the pocket, and kind of like being more aggressive about it.
There are certainly references that seem slightly veiled about artists, including Drake, Kanye West, but they're very specific mentions of things like the Grammys and the Super Bowl. How many scores are settled on this album, even if it's not entirely clear what score is being settled?
Jay-Z and Beyonce seem kind of elusive, and they're not going to go on the record about a lot of things in interviews, but then when you listen to the actual album, they're going to settle the scores. So yeah, Jay admitted that he declined to perform at the Super Bowl. He said, "You need me, I don't need you."
One of the other things that's notable, like Lemonade and 444, this album was first released exclusively on Tidal, which is a streaming service that's near and dear to the Jay and Beyonce household. Now, Everything Is Love is available on Spotify and Apple Music. What did they have to say in the album about streaming, and what does the release of this record suggest about their views on streaming?
Their previous albums, Lemonade and 444, were Tidal exclusives, and Everything Is Love on the first day was also a Tidal exclusive. Basically, on one of the songs, Beyonce says, "I don't give two f- about streaming numbers."
Patiently waiting for my demise, because my success can't be quantified. If I gave two F's, two F's, my streaming numbers would have put Lemonade up on Spotify.
What I think is weird is now Everything Is Love is on Spotify Premium. So it's not available to people who are only on the first tier of Spotify. You have to be a paid subscribe member. I think that's very pointed in terms of they want to get the maximum amount of royalties possible from this album. But I still think it's strange that the first two albums in this so-called trilogy is not available to a lot of the public who aren't on Tidal. And for some reason, they want the finale of the saga to be available to everyone, because maybe they know that everyone knows the story by now.
Michelle Kim is an associate staff writer at Pitchfork. Michelle, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Hey, no need to ask, you heard about us. No need to ask, you heard about us. Already know you know about us.
Coming up, someone once said that being a successful writer often means exploiting the worst moments of your life. Tony Award-winning playwright Stephen Karam can relate.
No time, but we got protects. Come around stepping on next. My chica got knickers upset. Why? Oh, why these skitchy so mad for? They don't want y'all say on there.
KBCC podcasts are supported by Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series. And Freeform's Grown-ish, produced by ABC Signature Studios. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Yara Shahidi, and Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's series One Strange Rock, hosted by Will Smith and executive produced by Darren Aronofsky and Newtopia. An elite ensemble of astronauts tells the unexpected and unprecedented story of Earth, filmed across 900,000 plus miles, 45 countries, 6 continents, and outer space. Emmy eligible in all categories. Visit natgeotv.com/FYC for more information. Don't just consider. Explore.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. And just a quick reminder, you can always hear this show as a podcast. Just subscribe to The Frame from Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to listen. And now, have you ever had a really bad family dinner? Well, maybe you should turn that experience into a play. That's part of what inspired Stephen Karam to write The Humans, a drama that unfolds over a Thanksgiving meal. Three generations of a family, plus a potential son-in-law, gather in a dingy New York apartment, not so much to break bread and carve a turkey, but to cross swords and occasionally sing.
Lay down your fears and raise your glass. May peace and joy be with you all.
Amy's turn.
Yeah, singing.
Oh, may all the
friends that e'er I had, they'd be sorry at my going away. I'm a lawyer, Rich.
There are plenty of laughs in the show, but The Humans is ultimately a serious look into what binds a family together and what can tear it apart. The Humans was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, but it lost to a little show called Hamilton, so it had to settle for winning the 2016 Tony Award for Best Play. Now it's finally having its L.A. debut at the Amundsen Theater, and the cast includes Reed, Bernie, and Jane Houdyshell, who won Tonys for their performances in the Broadway production. When I spoke with Stephen Karam back during the show's New York run, we began with a moment that ultimately led to The Humans getting to Broadway. And that was when the prominent movie and theater producer Scott Rudin went to see the play before it even opened off Broadway.
Well, he saw, I believe it was a Sunday matinee, and the show hadn't opened yet. We were in sort of the last week of previews before press would start arriving. And I received a call saying that Scott had seen the show and liked it very much, and that was a good feeling. And then I think there was another call maybe a day later, again, this was all before the show opened, saying that Scott was interested in moving the show to Broadway, which certainly was unprecedented in my own career, but I think even for anybody who knows the industry, for a play with no stars, I'm certainly not a name. The play was not well known. So for anyone to aspire to move something to Broadway before even, you know, the positive reviews come out, I was astonished and I think even a little skeptical, like this can't possibly be true. So I just kept on, you know, Joe Mantel and I were just kept working on the play for those final few previews.
Joe is your director.
Joe Mantel, the director of The Humans, yeah. But it was all true. I mean, Scott had put down a deposit and was actively sort of the wheels were already spinning before we had even had our opening night. So I don't know that I'll ever have an experience like that again.
I want to talk about some of the story elements of The Humans. You grew up in Pennsylvania and live in New York. That's mirrored in a part of the story. I want to talk about the difference in your mind between kind of textual autobiography, events that happen that are repeated in emotional autobiography, and you find yourself kind of working more toward emotional autobiography than actual autobiography.
Sure, and I think that kind of emotional autobiography is something that I would hazard the guess that every writer is doing this. So I don't think this is a unique thing. I think it's just my way of talking about it because in the case of The Humans, there are so many, let's say if you want to go on a treasure hunt of facts that might line up. You know, I currently do live in Chinatown in a tenement apartment. I did used to live in a basement duplex apartment. And when there's enough kernels of specific facts that match like that, I think people then want to know more and more, you know, is this literally your family? Are you the lesbian lawyer, you know, working at the M&A law firm? What diseases do you have? Are those literally your parents? Are they? So I think I walked into this problem because, you know, if you do have enough things that line up, people want to know more. But I just think you can go deeper and be more honest about the things that are really weighing on your mind, the questions that really keep you up at night, if you do hide behind a shield of fiction. And so that's what I mean by it being emotional biography, but not not lining up in the way that maybe would make for a really exciting story, which is that was an actual Thanksgiving dinner that I just had last year.
I think one of the things that's notable about the play is that even though it's dealing with some difficult and serious issues, it's really funny. And there's a lot of laughter. Was that your intention in writing it? Do you anticipate how funny it would play? Or are you constantly surprised by how light the audience takes a lot of the story?
So, I mean, none of it is necessarily intentional, but my worldview is, you know, I do think people are, and life in general is pretty hilarious and funny and entertaining. And I also think it's sad and dark and complicated and a little scary and, you know, and exhilarating and joyful. And so I don't know that I'll ever write a play that doesn't have a lot of laughs because I just kind of think it's where I live. And so it's kind of where my writing lives.
if people read your play in addition to seeing it, and I've read it, your play reads very much like a screenplay. And you've written some screenplays. You've adapted your own play, Speech and Debate, and Chekhov's The Seagull for movies. When you're writing, you're very specific about stage direction. You're very specific about where people are standing in relation to another on this two-level set in terms of what they can and cannot hear or what they can and cannot see. You're very specific about sound design, the thumps and clunks and noises that one hears watching the play. Do you kind of think about playwriting and screenwriting in more similar terms than most people might, in terms of the way in which you're setting words on the page and describing what you want to see happen on stage?
That's a good question. I mean, I do think they're completely separate sort of genres. So I do approach both very differently. But now that you've said that, I'm thinking about how I am very visually oriented as a playwright. So that's probably what you're responding to. And I think this play in particular, The Humans, it is so dependent on the architecture of this duplex apartment, this basement level, you know, space that is essentially a character in the show, that probably more than anything else I've ever written, the play and the script are attuned to the architecture of this space, and it just is very obsessed with the spatial relations of where these characters are, you know, who's in the foreground, who's in the background, who's in the kitchen alley, who's pacing up and down a hallway. So there was a degree to which I was hyper aware of, let's say, the architecture, which is not always the case. I mean, my last play had sort of a voided set, took place in 12 different locations, and, you know, I really wasn't sure what it would look like. And this, while you can never know what the actual design is that you'll end up with, there were certain parameters that sort of had to be in place. So to that degree, yeah, I think it's unusually obsessed with space.
You wrote Speech and Debate in your 20s, and I was thinking about having a conversation with the composer Philip Glass not that long ago, and he was talking about how he couldn't support himself through music alone until he was in his 40s. Do you remember the point or the day or the week when you realized that you could support yourself as a playwright and not have a day job?
That's an interesting question. I there wasn't an exact moment, only because I held on to my day job for a very, very long time. Speech and Debate opened and closed, and I was still at the law firm. I was working as a legal assistant, you know, an administrative assistant at a Canadian law firm here in the city, and I was there for about 7 years, and it was 30 hours a week, and I just quickly discovered that the security that kind of job was giving me was allowing me to take more risks as a writer. Mm-hmm. It gave me permission to fail. And
because you knew it would be there. You knew you would have a paycheck or something to come fall back on.
Exactly. And I knew that it was okay if I, you know, if Speech Debate opened and was a flop, or if Sons of the Prophet, my next play, opened and was a flop, that was okay. And that created its own kind of excitement for me. And I stuck with that job until I had opened Sons of the Prophet, and then only left because I didn't have enough vacation days to do I had written a libretto for a chamber opera. Basically, the timing of that production, plus Sons of the Prophet was opening in Boston and then was coming to New York. It was the first time that I didn't actually have enough vacation days to participate in these projects. So I kind of really only left when I didn't really have an option. And by that point, Sons of the Prophet then ended up doing pretty well. It had a successful off-Broadway run. And so I guess that was the moment where the cord was cut. And for better or for worse, here I am as a playwright trying to, without a day job, but there's a part of me that still thinks maybe all playwrights should have a day job if it allows us to be completely fearless in our, you know, and courageous in our writing.
Stephen Karam is the playwright of The Humans. Stephen, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
The Humans runs through July 29th at the Amundsen Theater in downtown LA. Coming up, we'll meet the real-life paleontologist who inspired Sam Neill's character in the Jurassic franchise. Yes, in case you somehow haven't heard, the dinosaurs are back.
She was a shark smile in a yellow van. She came around and I stole the plants in my youth. The vampire, Evelyn, shone quiet as roses.
KPCC supporters include HBO, presenting Westworld. Live without limits in a world where every human appetite can be indulged. This dark odyssey follows the dawn of artificial consciousness and the evolution of sin. In this hit series, a group of android hosts deviate from their programmers' carefully planned scripts in a disturbing pattern of aberrant behavior. Chaos takes control in the second season of Westworld, Emmy eligible for Outstanding Drama Series and all other categories.
Incredibles 2 ruled the box office this past weekend, and now comes another sequel with equally high ticket sale expectations. It's Jurassic World: Fallen Kingdom. The origins of the film franchise trace back to Michael Crichton's 1990 novel Jurassic Park and the dinosaur-packed movie that it spawned in 1993, directed by Steven Spielberg. Paleontologist Jack Horner helped inspire the Dr. Alan Grant character in Crichton's novel. In the film, he's played by the actor Sam Neill. Horner has also been a technical advisor on all of the Jurassic movies. The frame producer Monica Bushman found out what that entails.
My name is Jack Horner. I'm a paleontologist, and I focus primarily on dinosaur behavior, dinosaur ecology, and dinosaur evolution.
I read your book.
Oh, it's great.
Do you really think that dinosaurs turned into birds? And that's where they all went?
Since Michael Crichton had created his character based on, at least on part of my research, Steven Spielberg called me and asked me if I would work on Jurassic Park with him as a scientific advisor.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
What Steven wanted was he wanted me to help assure that the dinosaurs were as accurate as they could be based on the latest science we had, and also make sure that, you know, any science that they put in the movie was as accurate as it could be without taking anything away from the movie.
It's just the two raptors, right? You sure the third one's contained?
Yes. Unless they figured out how to open doors.
One of my favorite scenes in the first movie was the kitchen scene. The original script had the raptors coming into the kitchen. They were after the children at that time. And they come into the kitchen, and in the original script, the raptors were coming into the kitchen and sticking out their forked tongues, like very much like snakes or lizards do. And I stepped in and said, you know, they really can't do that. Dinosaurs didn't have forked tongues like lizards or snakes. So we need to take that out. And so Steven didn't argue with me. Sometimes he argued with me, but this time he didn't. But he said, you know, we need to fill that space. If we're going to take that scene out, we need to fill it with something else. And so it was later decided that before the dinosaurs come into the kitchen, they would look through that window into the kitchen, and the dinosaur would snort, and it would fog up the window. Only warm-blooded animals can fog up a window. So it's a tiny little suggestion that dinosaurs are warm-blooded.
Indominus Rex, our first genetically modified hybrid.
Well, how did you get two different kinds of dinosaurs to, you know...
Oh, Indominus wasn't bred. She was designed.
The hybrid dinosaur in Jurassic World was something I got to actually work on, and I've always said it's the most accurate dinosaur in all of the movies because, of course, it's designed by humans. The Jurassic Park movies, you know, really are, it's a story right from the very beginning. So we can't really change those dinosaurs, the way they look, anywhere in the film. But nowadays, you know, we know that dinosaurs look very different. You know, when I was working on the film in 1993, we made the dinosaurs look as accurate as we could based on the time, except for we knew at that time that some dinosaurs, especially the raptors, had feathers. But there was a technical problem making feathers in the computer graphics. So we weren't able to make feathered dinosaurs at the time, but we know now that most of the meat-eating dinosaurs should have been feathered.
Nothing in Jurassic World is natural.
We've tried to fix that along the way by sort of having a caveat in the last Jurassic, you know, in Jurassic World, that basically says that the dinosaurs were genetically modified to be scary rather than accurate.
If their genetic code was pure, many of them would look quite different, but you didn't ask for reality. You asked for more teeth.
I never asked for a monster.
Monster is a relative term.
I think the thing that really interests kids and anyone, what dinosaurs actually do for people, is we're looking at, you know, first off, they're gigantic. A Tyrannosaurus rex is 40 feet long. Some of these big sauropods, you know, are 100 feet long. They're just enormous animals. And they're different than anything that's alive today, completely different. There's no animal alive today that looks like a dinosaur. And they're gone. So they're just like these gigantic imagination engines, especially for little kids.
That was paleontologist Jack Horner, the technical advisor on Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. The movie opens this Friday. And one last item as we wrap up. For the second straight time, a John Travolta movie has earned a remarkable 0% score on Rotten Tomatoes, meaning that not a single critic gave his latest film, the mob drama Gotti, a positive review. 2 years ago, Travolta's film Life on the Line also got a unanimous 0% score on Rotten Tomatoes. Brian Tallarico at RogerEbert.com said of the new film, he may have been a murderer, but even John Gotti deserved better. And the New York Post Johnny Oleksinski said, I'd rather wake up next to a severed horse head than ever watch Gotti again. And that is the show for today. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You will find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. We'll see you back here tomorrow.